supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
For children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Thousands of people from the East Coast spend the winters in Florida or other warm destinations. And according to the Travel Industry Association, 25% of all travel takes place during the cold, dark winter months. Most travelers, of course, are trying to look for warmer climates and, of course, sunshine. It's common to dread winter or to get a light case of the winter blues, but for people suffering seasonal affective disorder, this time of year brings on serious symptoms: depression, anxiety, insomnia, and fatigue. On today's show, we'll discuss who's at risk, why, and what the therapeutic options are. My guest is Dr. Janice Anderson. She's an assistant professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and she's the director of the Seasonal Affective Disorders Clinical Services in Brigham and Women's Hospital. Janice, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Our phone number here is 888-477-9499. If you've got seasonal affective disorder, or wonder if you do, or if a loved one does, number is 888-477-9499. Well, Janice, let's start with the symptoms. And what are the symptoms, and how does it differ from a clinical depression?
Actually, the symptoms of SAD are the symptoms of a clinical depression. So what sets this apart is simply the timing. That is, that it reliably comes on at a certain time of year and then will remit or go away at another time of year. So typically, in New England, for instance, in the fall, people become depressed, and then in the spring, they no longer have depression. It's true that for seasonal affective disorder, most commonly people have problems with oversleeping. So they may have difficulty getting up in the morning, feel very lethargic, and sometimes come home and go to bed very early in the evening and actually sleep more hours in the wintertime than they do at other times of year.
Well, it seems to me, as I listen to you, that our primordial brains would have us do just that. I mean, it's dark and it's cold, and you hang out inside and you sleep more and you know, put on some fat and rest up for the spring. Is today's pace of life doesn't permit that. I you know, when I first started reading about this, I wondered, is it our brains fighting against our lifestyles to a certain extent?
Oh, absolutely. And if you think about it, here I am in Boston looking at the snow for during the time that mammals were evolving. Dealing with winter conditions is serious business, and it's important for the brain to be able to prepare us to cope with those unique environmental challenges. So there's actually a kind of built-in calendar that's based on the internal clock that the brain can keep track of, both time of day and also time of year, so that animals can be prepared for what's coming, especially something as serious as winter. And it is true, when studies have been done, for instance, in Alaska or in Siberia, comparing rates of SAD among people who have a traditional lifestyle, indigenous people to that area, versus people who are living a more industrialized lifestyle, actually the people with the indigenous lifestyle did not have the high rates of SAD that their neighbors who were trying to live a modern lifestyle suffered from.
Well, while you're on that, help us understand that a little more carefully. You talked about a study that took place in Toronto, and they studied people who were from Icelandic descent and people who were not.
Oh, yes. There's a researcher, Magnusson, who's done a number of studies. Interesting that people in Iceland seem to be fairly resilient. And in looking at people whose ancestors were from Iceland, who lived in Canada, in Toronto, he found the people of Icelandic descent had lower rates of SAD than their neighbors who had other kinds of heritage. So there is some evidence that there may be some people who genetically are better able to adapt, and there may be lifestyle factors also.
Well, as long as we're talking about geography, I want you to listen to a piece our producer Mike and Scott did. She spoke with KUAC reporter Dan Bross about winters in Fairbanks, Alaska. Let's listen.
Dan, tell me about the winters in Fairbanks.
This is a very cold and dark place during the winter. We can get temperatures down to 50 degrees Fahrenheit below zero. Extremely cold. And also, during the middle part of the winter, it's very dark. On December 21st, the solstice, we had less than 4 hours of daylight, and that daylight was the sun just barely peeking over the horizon. So it wasn't like bright sun overhead for 4 hours. It was just very dim daylight.
So what do you guys do over the winter?
Well, it affects different people differently, and it changes over time. Some people may be okay with the darkness for the first few years they're here, and then it'll start to bother them. They'll become depressed and feel somewhat desperate during this part of the winter. So the most common things people do are to just try to get outside during that middle part of the day, whether that's exercise or just for a walk or just to get to a window and see the light, because it's important to us. Or it can be something like an artificial sun lamp, and these are actually locally made. They're full-spectrum lights that you put in your house or somewhere where you're going to sit for a period of time in the morning, maybe during your breakfast, and expose yourself to this full-spectrum light that kind of simulates the sun.
How long have you lived in Alaska?
I've been here since 1992.
And how do you deal with the winters? How is it for you personally?
Well, you know, personally for me, I think of it sort of like deep sea diving. You take a big breath and you go down under for this period of the winter, but it's not an inactive time, and that's sort of how I deal with it. I really like to cross-country ski and to run, and I do those things. I probably spend more time exercising during the dark cold of the winter than I do in the summer. And that's really a good way to get through it. Just, you know, exercise, of course, no matter where you live, is proven to make you feel better. But in a place like this, getting outside and experiencing the beauty of the dark and cold, because there is a lot of that. We have amazing northern lights, the aurora, as well as the stars and the moon, you know, just beautiful. The snow cover we have makes any available light reflected. And, you know, it's quite beautiful to be outside.
Now, when does winter start, and how long does it last, typically?
It can get wintry here as early as September. My first winter here in 1992, it was dropping below zero in early September. We received several feet of snow while the leaves were still on the trees, and winter really never relented until late in the spring. More typically, we have snow by mid-October and skiable snow probably by Halloween sometimes, and then it, you know, begins to be below zero rather consistently for the low, and it will stay that way until maybe February when the sun is strong enough to start bumping the midday temperatures, you know, up into more seasonable temperatures, maybe, you know, 20 degrees above, something like that. But we rarely see temperatures above freezing until late in the spring, maybe April.
You've talked about the beauty of the cold season. Are there certain things that people do to celebrate just this time of year and to say, hey, we're all in this together, we're going to get through this?
Certainly. I mean, solstice is a big deal up here. You know, there's the standard bonfires and fireworks displays around Christmas and New Year's, because this is the time of year we do fireworks in the north, because in the summer around 4th of July, you just can't see them. So this is a big time of year for fireworks, and we just recently completed a number of local displays that people got to enjoy. But it's tough living when it's cold. And any little thing that goes wrong can cause you a lot of problems as far as, you know, your car not working or your heater at home having problems. You know, it's a struggle to get through these the cold snaps when we do get them. It's tough stuff. So there's no getting around that. But yeah, you know, people have a certain hardiness, and we share that. In other words, you know, people are helpful to each other. Everyone knows that, you know, they've experienced the tough time when their car wouldn't go or their furnace went down, and they're ready to help. And you know, we're in it together for sure.
Dan Bross, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And let's hope for an early spring.
Okay.
Dan Bross is a reporter from KUAC in Fairbanks, Alaska. He spoke with Mike and Scott, and we're back with Dr. Janice Anderson, who's an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, and she runs the Seasonal Affective Disorders Clinical Services, Brigham and Williams Hospital. So we do know then that geography is a big factor here, but what are the other risk factors, Janice?
Well, it's interesting. This certainly was an example of a well-adapted guy.
Yeah.
He mentioned several things that were particularly important, including getting outdoors and actually seeing what light is there. So it is true that we don't appreciate sometimes how much more light there is outdoors, even in Alaska in the winter, than indoors, and that difference in amount seems to relate to what's helpful to mood about light. And so getting outdoors for people in the winter when that's possible certainly can be helpful. Getting exercise, another very important factor, as you know in the research, even with non-seasonal depression, exercise can be helpful in keeping people out of depression or getting people out of depression. So that's another super factor that he mentioned. And the other thing was about the social aspect, the kind of community working together aspect. So it's terribly important when people start to feel depressed and oftentimes have the impulse to avoid people and pull back, that the more people can remain socially engaged and interacting, the better when it comes to helping to alleviate depression.
Whether it's seasonal or good old-fashioned clinical depression.
Precisely. Well, so if there's something unique here with SAD, it really seems to be the kind of cues that light can send through the brain about time of year, and the effect that that has on things that have to do not only with feelings, but also with the running of the body, the metabolism, the energy level, the preparedness to be active.
Well, I want to come back to an original question I asked you. The light, in a way, is that tricking the brain into thinking it's not winter?
That was certainly the premise of the first studies on SAD. And in fact, in those original studies done with taxpayer funds at the National Institute of Mental Health, they were really trying to simulate a summer day. So they used bright light both at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day to create essentially a day that was as long as it is in summer in terms of how much light there is. Mm. And that really seemed to be effective, but it rapidly became apparent that that was not necessary in order to get a benefit from light. And we know now that because of the way the timing system in our brain responds to light, there's a particularly strong effect when light comes first thing after you wake up. And so oftentimes now we use shorter amounts, particularly first thing in the morning.
I wonder, thinking about who's at risk, are women more at risk than men? And I wonder about age, or older people more at risk than younger people who would, I would think, be more affected by the cold?
It seems to be yes and no. Yes, that women more than men complain of SAD, much like other forms of depression where women also have higher rates. But in this case, maybe 2 to 3 times more women than men complain of seasonal affective disorder. As far as age, although there are cases in children and adolescents, the most common age for people to really become aware of this problem is actually in the early 20s. And so it seems when people have a history of SAD, starting in their early adulthood, it's liable to persist, and there's not so much an increased risk at advanced age.
And I'm sure people with a history of depression are at increased risk, I would imagine.
It's true, certainly, even people with a history of a family history of mood disorder have higher rates.
When is it time? You know, I introduced the show by saying we all get a bit of cabin fever. When is it time to see a doctor?
Well, certainly, if someone has symptoms of depression, and by this I mean, of course, feeling a loss of interest or pleasure in usual activities, a decrease in mood, a change in sleep, energy level, thinking negatively about yourself and about the world and your future, any of those combination, people really should seek help at any point, talk to a clinician, a family doctor, and get it evaluated. But with SAD, it's the unique factor that you really need a kind of long-term perspective. For some people, this is tough because their life is so filled with daily ups and downs, it's hard to remember one year to the next. But for people who have a pretty predictable lifestyle, it may start to dawn on them that they really feel this way every November or every December. And in that case, the diagnosis of SAD certainly can be explored.
And unlike other depressions, SAD, you can go into it knowing that it will pass.
Correct. And so it is true, you know, there's the phenomena of double depression. And historically, people have talked about that being a combination of a real sharp episode of deep depression at times, but also maybe a persisting long-term feeling more often than not pretty bad. And so some people, unfortunately, have both of those. You can also think about SAD as a potential add-on. So somebody can have another mood disorder, a bipolar disorder, a major depressive disorder, but it may regularly worsen in the winter months.
Right.
So that worsening component is the thing that we particularly address with light treatment.
Well, and speaking of light treatment, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk more about light treatment and the various other treatments that are available. We're talking about seasonal affective disorder today on Voices. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you have it, if you think you have it, or if a loved one has it, give us a call, 888-477-9499. My guest is Dr. Janice Anderson. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and the director of the Seasonal Affective Disorders Clinical Services at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
They say in the year 1900 alone, over 2 million people went to the Yiddish theater.
This is Larry Josephson. Join me for Becoming Americans, a journey through the Lower East Side of New York. Part of the series, Only in America, 350 years of the American Jewish experience.
Wednesday night at 11 on WHYY.
And And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about seasonal affective disorder today, and the treatment most commonly used for SAD is light. Our production assistant, Gita Simons, visited the Thomas Jefferson University's Medical College in Philadelphia to discuss light treatment therapy.
Light boxes have been in use since the early 1980s. Psychologist Dr. Brenda Byrne, director of the Seasonal Affective Disorder Clinic at Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia, remembers that in those early days, light therapy was very time-consuming.
Some of the early patients in research studies would be in front of one of these boxes for 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the evening, a whole lot of time, but they felt so much better. I was amazed that they were very willing to keep doing that. Luckily, within a few years, it was found that if you increase the brightness, you could cut down on the time of exposure.
Today, light units come in all shapes and sizes. At his lab, Dr. George Brainerd, who is the director of Jefferson's Light Research Program, has set up several examples. The first unit he turns on is a square box with many parallel fluorescent tubes.
You notice right away, it's substantially brighter than indoor lighting. A patient would typically sit about 30 inches away from this device for a period of 30 to 45 minutes in the morning.
The light is blinding almost. Are patients supposed to look directly into the light?
Patients are generally instructed to have this light nearby them during the period of therapy. They can carry on quiet activities such as reading a book or watching television, but they're instructed to look up and look directly at the light approximately once a minute or so.
It seems intuitive that light would help people who get depressed, fatigued, or anxious over the winter. That's why we travel to sunny destinations to escape the dark, dreary season. But how does light affect our moods and well-being? What happens in the brain? As light enters the human eye, it stimulates our visual system. But light also stimulates non-visual parts of the brain, parts that are connected to our biological clock.
What's been found in the last 7 years is that there is a separate photoreceptor for the biological and behavioral, and we believe possibly the therapeutic effects of light. And this is really an astonishing discovery. What we found essentially is the eye is just like the human ear. The ear has two sensory systems as well. One sensory system allows us to hear the world, like your listeners on the radio. The other in the ear is keeping track of your position relative to gravity and acceleration, and that's what allows us to stand upright and sit upright and not lose our balance. So similarly, the human eye has two distinct sensory systems, one for the visual effects of light, the other for the biological, behavioral, and probably the therapeutic effects of light.
With the better understanding of how and why light therapy works, there's a proliferation of different gadgets available to consumers. Some are small portable units, some can be worn as visors, and one is called the Dawn Simulator.
This is a device that raises the light in the bedroom prior to the wake-up time in a very slow fashion. I'm going to show it to you a little quicker than it would normally go off, but it raises the light in the sleeping area of the patient or the person using it. And it really accelerates the wake-up of the individual as well as seems to have therapeutic benefit.
With all of these gadgets to choose from, psychologist Dr. Brenda Byrne likes to remind her patients that it's not so much the device that is helping them improve.
I think we can forget that it's light that's the cure. And so I think a lot of people with SAD, if they could get up in the morning and go out of doors for a half hour, they wouldn't need to sit in front of a light unit for a half hour. But so many people with SAD hate the cold.
Most of Dr. Byrne's patients began light therapy in the fall, with increasing time spent in front of the light during the winter and tapering off during the spring. She says that in most cases, they see better results with light than they do with medications.
Light therapy doesn't make any changes to your body chemically in the way that medications do, and it tends to kick in faster than antidepressant medication does. Many people feel better within the first week.
Dr. George Brainerd and his colleagues are now studying what combination of frequencies and wavelengths are most beneficial in light therapy devices. He says the therapeutic effects of light are also attracting the attention of people outside of the field of seasonal affective disorder.
The lighting levels needed for vision are much lower than regulation of biology and behavior. The Illuminating Engineering Society of North America has taken a very big interest in this. They have formed a committee on light and health, and they are looking at the database now and involving scientists from the medical communities and the research communities, trying to inform them of how to proceed with future lighting designs. In fact, the door is wide open to some innovations that we think will affect all of architectural lighting.
For Voices in the Family, I'm Gita Simons.
Gita Simons spoke with Dr. Brenda Byrne, who's the director of the Seasonal Affective Disorder Clinic at Jefferson, and Dr. George Brainard. He's the director of Jefferson's Light Research Program. Well, joining us again is Dr. Janice Anderson. She runs the Seasonal Affective Disorders Clinical Services at Brigham and William Women's Hospital in Massachusetts. I'm also joined by Dr. Stephen Vasquez. He's a licensed professional counselor and the originator of a method called ETT, Emotional Transformation Therapy. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Let's talk about your underlying philosophy here about how trapped emotions cause symptoms that are affected by light.
Yes, I think that we as psychotherapists gather information differently than scientists would. We believe that by a bonding process with our clients, information about causes and factors that relate to their seasonal responses can be elicited in a different way, and we find that emotions are very much have a strong relationship with lighting, and as far as a reaction to light as well as eliciting a different perception of light.
Well, you, if I understand that, you say that people with depression or unresolved trauma are more sensitive to light in their environment.
Generally speaking.
So
yes.
How do we know that?
Well, we do a test where we expose them to various specific wavelengths of light, and so far, of the thousands we've done, there's been no two alike, so it's a highly sensitive test that shows the exact kind of response they have to each wavelength, each color of light. And so we break it down into specific wavelengths to see how that works, and we've mapped a whole series of emotional themes that coordinate with certain wavelengths of light, so we have an idea of what the problem is by virtue of that testing.
So you emotional transformation therapy uses a combination of traditional talk therapy and phototherapy, yes?
Correct, right.
So what does that look like? What happens if we were to put a video camera in your
therapy? Well, we have a person sitting when looking at specific lights while the therapist is sitting next to them, and as they're talking about their issues, we use certain specific colors to provoke emotions to the surface, and then certain processes and other colors to help resolve those, bring them to a quick conclusion. And so you see it's an amplification of normal psychotherapy. Everything goes faster, deeper than it normally would, so it's an accelerated form of treatment, and that sometimes we do in 10 sessions what might take 100 sessions to do otherwise. And we've noticed that when we're using this light stimulation, that there's a general sort of comparison as to how people respond to light. That sub-syndromes like fog environments, like overcast skies, and we've had a lot of people that have had those kinds of conditions as well as SAD, and found that we've been able to, about 10 sessions, have a permanent long-term effect on eliminating the SAD syndrome.
Tell me about the response of your colleagues in the larger scientific community.
Well, I published an article in the American Journal of Psychotherapy, and I've gotten hardly no responses to that particular article, but I've taught this as I teach around the world, around the country, this approach, and SAD is really somewhat rare. We don't get the classical SAD that often, but we have had a few cases to test it with. See, the problem is that before SAD was actually determined to be a condition, psychotherapy was used for all forms of depression, and I'm old enough to know that to have had cases where they got better before SAD was separated out as a subset of depression. And so I knew psychotherapy worked with it because they worked with it before the light revolution had taken place. And so then I began, of course, to couple psychotherapy with different forms of light to get more specific effects.
Well, it's tough to know if psychotherapy was working with seasonal affective disorder or, Janice, as you have said, was it tincture of time, you know, the season passing?
Actually, ironically, when I first started in this field in the mid-1980s, I did have patients who came for SAD research trials who had extensive psychotherapy prior to that time, and in some cases felt that they'd really resolved their issues. They were very well adjusted, and particularly in the spring, felt like they were through with psychotherapy. And then when the fall came and they began to get depressed again, it was very distressing to them. And so it was quite a relief to learn about the possibility that they had a form of depression that was responsive to the time of year, and they could try an additional tactic to deal with that, namely the light therapy.
Well, let me understand, Stephen. It sounds like you might be disagreeing with Janice a bit in that I think you're suggesting that seasonal affective disorder and other depressions are about emotions that have been buried in the body and not resolved.
Yeah, there's only two published articles in the professional journals about the use of psychotherapy. It has not been a focus of study. So, you know, we're clinicians, others are scientists, and they're looking at it in different ways than we are, so they're going to gather different information. But we've had people, of course, that it was long-term change, but it has to be psychotherapy focused on the SAD symptoms and the symptoms and the emotions related to that. You can work with a lot of emotions but not get the ones that are directly related to that. And that's how we've been successful. And the other is a form of self-help with it, which of course works, but it's a whole different paradigm as to how it operates. Theirs is used every day for long periods of time. Ours is done in a shorter period of time and more intensively, and we've been able to find long-term help, but we need some scientists to actually put it to the test now that we got the protocol down. So it's more of a clinical approach than it is a scientific approach.
You both, I am told, have done research on blue light therapy. Is that true, Janice? Let's start with you.
Yes. Actually, I could just interject, if I might.
Sure.
There is a form of psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, that's well established as an effective treatment for depression. And there has been some interesting work by Dr. Kelly Rohan in Maryland applying cognitive behavioral therapy to the treatment of patients with seasonal affective disorder. And so there is some data, certainly, to support that approach. Yes, as Dr. Brainerd in your piece was discussing, he's someone who's done a lot of very careful research about effects of light on the body clock, and he discussed some new developments in understanding the physiology of the retina, the specific cells that seem to be part of the timekeeping system, and how they're responsive to particular wavelengths of light. So here in the Boston area at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, there's also a lot of basic research going on the circadian timing system in people, and we've teamed up with those researchers to take a look at how some of these different wavelengths might specifically affect the timekeeping mechanism within the body.
And based on that piece of research and what Dr. Brainerd said, coming back to you, Stephen, do you think there will be a time when light will be used routinely or much more commonly in psychotherapy in general?
Well, that's exactly what I'm advocating, and if we can get more scientific testing of these things that we've seen in clinical settings over and over, then I think that it'll be obvious there's a better way to amplify the effects of psychotherapy.
I do want to push this a bit further, and maybe I'm taking this out of all three of our areas of expertise. But when I listen to your therapy, Stephen, I think of EMDR, the eye movement therapy that was started by Dr. Shapiro, that also is enjoying very great success. And what she does is evoke emotions while people are moving their eyes rapidly, following some kind of object moving back and forth. And that does elicit emotion, and it does apparently recalibrate emotion. So I wonder if something is going on in the brain that really touches an aspect of brain that is not necessarily just light doing it.
Well, yeah. We use specific forms of eye movements, but that's not a major part of what we do. In eye positions, we deal with the angle at which the light enters the eyes makes a huge difference in my process. And so there's a whole, I've already published an article on that subject, peripheral eye stimulation, which we've found to be very valuable. So it's not just that we're shining a light, but there's specific processes we use with the light stimulation. And it does have an effect very similar to the EMDR that you described. In some cases, it's there's a discovery aspect of it that's very different, because I've worked with several people. Most people are trained in EMDR, and they discover with this work that whole new venues of information emerge that they never got in EMDR. And this is particularly different as far as the way it elicits implicit memory to the surface, relevant implicit memory. And for the average person to understand it, if you think of a live theater, it's well known that they use specific colors to set specific moods in live theater. So this is more along that lines. We resonate colors with specific emotional states, and it basically amplifies the process.
And that's why the language we use for depression is language of colors, often gray and blue and dark emotions.
As well, with depression, it's well known many people have symptoms of they describe their environment visually as drab, dull, colorless, and that in terms of actually looking at a color, they'll see a less saturated color, which compares to that kind of description that they describe about their environment. And there are ways we can get the color to appear more saturated, which correlates with them getting back in touch with their emotions and coming alive again, so to speak.
Interesting. Stephen Vasquez, thanks so much for joining us.
Certainly.
Stephen Vasquez is a licensed professional counselor, and he's the originator of emotional transformation therapy. And he can be found at www.lightworkassociates.com. Well, Janice, we will. You'll be staying with us. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we've got some callers that want to join the conversation. And if you want to call in and join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about seasonal affective disorder with Dr. Janice Anderson. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and director of the Seasonal Affective Disorders Clinical Services at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. We'll be back after a short break right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Defense attorneys have been pioneering the use of brain scans to paint sympathetic portraits of their clients in the courtroom. Legal scholars say it's only a matter of time before neuroscience raises larger questions about guilt and innocence, even though scientists say the technology is only partially understood. On our next Justice Talking, Neuroscience and the Law.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Hello, everyone.
Recognize that voice?
I'm an exorcist. No, I'm a limo driver. No, I'm an undertaker. Yes, an escapee from an asylum clad in pajamas and a top hat.
Plus, he's Brian Unger.
All right, simmer down.
And he brings you his own twisted take on the news every Monday.
Oh, okay.
The Unger Report next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Thank you.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, SAD, Seasonal Affective Disorder. We're talking with Dr. Janice Anderson, who is the director of the Seasonal Affective Disorders Clinical Services Program at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Janice, is there something called too much light?
Absolutely. It is possible to get what one might think of as an overdose, and that's often kind of displayed with a feeling of too much energy, almost kind of feeling wired, like when you have too much caffeine. And so fortunately it's something that is quickly reversible, but it's important to us as we work with people to work to find the amount of light exposure that really is helpful and not overexpose people to light. So it's important for people to understand that there are safety concerns. Not every light is safe, and not every light is good for any given person.
And how does one find out? I would imagine an average GP wouldn't have that information.
Unfortunately not, and certainly we're looking forward to the day when the Food and Drug Administration really provides much more active guidance to clinicians about safety of light devices. Right now there are lots of devices that are on the market, and it's very difficult for the average consumer to know. I have the good fortune to work with companies that provide lights for research studies, and so those lights have been thoroughly tested, and we can be confident that their safety has been examined. But certainly when it comes to things that are reported to be full spectrum, we have to appreciate that that can include ultraviolet. And we really don't want people to get ultraviolet exposure to the retina.
Is there a web page our listeners could look at where they could get solid recommendations about what kind of lights? Or should they find someone who's a specialist in seasonal affective disorder? They're pretty hard to find.
Yes, and certainly there in Philadelphia, Dr. Burns Clinic is a tremendous resource because those are real experts. So for people who have that opportunity, I think an SAD clinic would be highly recommended. There is a professional organization, the Society for Light Treatment and Biological Rhythms, at www.sltbr.org. That's a professional society, and their members and web pages have information for the public.
Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We'll start with Craig. Craig, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have a comment and a question about St. John Wort. I have SADS, and I feel that St. John Wort, an herbal remedy, has really done wonders for me. And it just makes me feel better when I take it. And I was wondering what chemical in there causes me to feel better.
Yeah, let's. Thanks so much for your call, Craig. Let's talk about that, and because there's some research that I had read years ago, Janice, about St. John's Wort having an impact on the milder forms of depression.
Yes, and your caller certainly has raised the $64,000 question, which is how does it do that? And fortunately right now no one knows, but certainly there is a lot of data to suggest it can be helpful. Coincidentally, one of the key figures scientifically in research on SAD, Dr. Norman Rosenthal, who's written some very nice books, including one called Winter Blues that really summarizes what's known about seasonal affective disorder, has also written a book summarizing what's known about using St. John's Wort in treatment of depression. So some readers may find Dr. Rosenthal's work to be very informative.
If one has a history of seasonal affective disorder, does it make sense to start treatment before it starts? Light boxes, maybe St. John's Wort, increasing exercise.
It's a question that people have explored in research. The catch is that you really want to know that something you're doing is effective. So it can be helpful the first time around to wait until you have some symptoms, and then you can try the treatment and see if it helps. And certainly if you find a treatment which you know is effective, then the following year it might make sense to actually start ahead of time. There is one drug that has been approved by the FDA specifically for SAD, and in that case they did test using it to stave off episodes.
And?
They did find that there was some benefit from taking the drug, but again, this is something that requires a lot of study. Like any of these,
right.
Any one study is not really going to supply all the answers.
More
research certainly would be helpful.
What is the drug?
Wellbutrin.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. We've got John on the line. John,
thank you.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering whether or not any study has been done on blind people with seasonal affective disorder. That I'm blind, and I find myself sleeping a lot more in the wintertime. I like getting out. I do admit that I hate the cold, but I try to get out every day. But my problem is that I am very dependent on other people, both pedestrians, bicyclists, car drivers, being able to see me. And if they can't see me, then I'm in twice the danger I'm normally in. So I just wondered whether or not, I hear an awful lot in your program about using light therapy to help. And
well,
I'm just wondering whether any study has been done on SAD in connection with blind people.
Well, wait, before you're bringing up a couple of questions, John, and one I don't understand. You said you depend on people being able to see you, and of course that makes sense. But how is that affected in the winter?
Well, because they in the wintertime, that it gets dark so much earlier.
Gotcha, okay.
So I would have been able to perhaps walk until 8 or 9 o'clock in the summertime. But now in the community, you know, I really have to be in by 4 because of my fear of vulnerability.
That's interesting. So it's vulnerability as much as anything else.
It really is. I don't know how light therapy would help me, but I think that since I can't see, but I have to be aware of the fact that I can't see them, and if they can't see me, then I can be in real problems.
Well, it's really an interesting question. Janice, let's hear your reaction, and maybe this is kind of an indirect byproduct of the season changing and might not even be really seasonal affective disorder.
Well, in answer to John's other question, yes, there is research, and actually if he would like to call the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and talk to people in the sleep medicine research area, they have been doing many studies with blind individuals. As you suggest, Dr. Gottlieb, certainly there's a possibility for more than one thing going on. And part of it could certainly be additional stress in the winter. But going back to what Dr. Brainerd talked about, because there are these two different functions of the eye, what they've found is that there may be some people whose visual system is impaired. They're blind. They can't see. But the timekeeping mechanism in the eye may still be working. So it's possible for light to have some effects on the circadian timing mechanism in those folks, even though they are not able to see. So studying blind individuals certainly is an area of active interest, and a few people have made some case reports about SAD and blind individuals, but so far there have not been any systematic studies of that problem.
That's interesting. And John, you know, you made me aware. You know, I dread winters myself, and being in a wheelchair, I dread them for the same reasons. I can't get around as well, and people have to put on my coat, which I hate, and so on and so forth. So it might be SAD. It could be something else. It could be both. I think it was a fascinating question, and I appreciate your answer, Janice. Let's see if we can get another call in. We've got Zoe on the line. Zoe, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. My question was, if there's been any research done about women who have suffered what they called postpartum depression, but really they had their babies in the winter, and again, it's sort of the same thing where you're trapped inside. Both my sister and I had babies in January, and both were diagnosed with postpartum depression. But I just think there's a big difference between having your baby when you can have the freedom to go outside versus being shut in with a newborn.
Boy, isn't that interesting, Janice?
That's another fascinating question, absolutely. I would say, no, I don't know of any specific studies that address that, and it certainly is a worthwhile subject. It is true, I would add, though, that there have been some preliminary studies on using light to treat depression in women while they're pregnant. Though some women are reluctant to take antidepressant medication during pregnancy, and there was some interesting preliminary work. Dr. Dan Oren in New York did a study treating pregnant women with light, and so it's another area that we could sure use some more research study, and you raise a very intriguing question.
And what would be the downside here of Zoe trying it, or people in her position?
Twofold. I mean, the main thing is knowing what to do with it. So downsides would be making sure you have a light that's safe so that you're not running a risk of injuring your eyes. Mm-hmm. The second thing would be, just as I said about overdose, finding the right amount. So just like anything, you can have too much of a good thing. It's important for people to have some guidance in when and how to use the light. And then thirdly, just for the sake of not wasting time and money. So it does cost some money to get increased light, and it, frankly, it's difficult. The kind of light that we're talking about for the traditional SAD therapy is enough so that it's virtually an outdoor level of light inside. If you imagine taking a picture with a camera that requires a flash, if you go outdoors even on a crummy day, you don't need the flash. If you're indoors, even if it seems very bright, you still do. That's because there are far fewer photons typically indoors. So these devices that we're using are really very specially constructed. And people can waste money putting in higher-powered bulbs in their room and not really get much benefit.
Given that, give us the call letters of that webpage.
www.sltbr.org. That's Society for Light Treatment and Biological Rhythms.
Janice Anderson, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a wealth of important information. Janice Anderson, Assistant Professor of Psychology at Harvard. She's Director of Seasonal Affective Disorders Clinical Services at Brigham and Women's Hospital. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Our associate producer is Elisa Walters. Gita Simons helped produce the show. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I've been sitting in the studio for an hour with no lights. I got to get out of here. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.